This podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
We've never had that before. I've never had the intro stop working like that. That was a...
It's weird.
It was interesting. Do we want to try that again?
Oh, we can, yeah. Fuck, my knee just dislocated.
Well, put it back in while the intro's playing.
Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
Another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
And now the intro actually worked.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah. No, yeah, my knee is really weird. It just dislocated sitting at my chair. It's the third time it's done it. And then I'm able to move it and it pops right back in. It's so weird. Yeah.
Well, this is why they won't let you go back to work, because you can't be chasing bad guys and have your knee just pop out randomly.
I'm just popping out at the chair.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Do you imagine you're like on a call, you're talking to a victim or you're talking to a gangbanger, and all of a sudden your knee just buckles on you? That's why you can't do this. You know, and that's not even mentioning your back.
No, yeah, and that's not, yeah, absolutely. I'd be just sitting there, and the next thing you know, hold on, don't touch me. My back just went. And then you're just like, I can't move. Call an ambulance.
Yep.
And then they touch you. You have to fight, and it's not going to work. And I always told someone, if I ever had a bad back spasm where my leg stopped working, I was like, and it was a fight, someone's getting fucking shot. Because if my legs don't work, I'm fucked. I can't fight. I can't grapple. Right. I can just do this.
And departments aren't typically fond of having police on the street who are like, hey, my legs might give out at any time. And if that happens, I'm just going to shoot.
right. They're going to be like, that's a risk management issue, man. That's not safe. Exactly. No shit, it's not safe. Oh, I got news on that, though.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I figured I'd give people an update.
I mean, you've been updating people for the last 2 years, 3 years.
Yeah. This another mundane update. They're trying to, because I got put permanently qualified permanent disabled worker, whatever bullshit that is. Mm-hmm. They want to see if they can accommodate my needs while I'm finishing the end of the process so they can bring me back just to do fucking clerical work. I'm like, what the fuck? All right.
Okay, go back and do clerical work. And you won't be...
I don't want to go back unless it's like working a detective table. You know what I mean?
They're not going to do that. You're retiring out. They're not going to put you in detectives just to retire you out.
Just give me some experience. Help me out a little bit.
No, they're not going to do that. Okay, you just said help me out to a police department. That's never going to happen.
No, they're going
to. You could be drowning, suicidal, alcoholic, suffering from PTSD, and you ask your department for help out, and they're going to be that meme where the guy high fives the drowning man and flies away in a helicopter, because that's what fucking departments do.
Yeah.
But this week, last week we did a surprise live debrief, which I think we had fun doing, and I like the theme. Like that was a good theme. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about coming up. So send us those videos for live debriefs. Also, for those of you who listened to Locker Room last week, man, that Baltimore bridge collapse was insane. So if you want to know about more current events, and you want to hear our thoughts on things that are going on in the world that aren't specifically law enforcement, military, or public safety related, but actually you want to hear it from the perspective of, you know, reasonable people. I mean, Matt's not that reasonable, let's face it. But anyway, so we have a guest this week. Chuck, tell us about our guest as we bring Derek onto the program. Hey, Derek, how are you?
Good evening, Phyllis.
Afternoon. evening.
Yeah, evening where you're at, and after. Yes. We've talked to people who are in the future on this show. We've talked to people who, for them, it was tomorrow.
I am so. 3 hours in your future.
Ooh, tell me, did I get drunk?
I'm sorry, we don't get those details.
The Aussie would be like, "Fuck yeah!"
Just mate. Like the lottery numbers, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So we have
Derek.
Yeah, so we have Derek. He wrote in because one of his buddies actually listened to the show and hooked him onto it. So I think the thing at the end, the little blip I read at the end, is working because we got Derek to come in and was told about us, and he was swapping some stories with a buddy, and they said, "Hey, you'd be a great fit for the show." So he wrote on in, and he is a volunteer firefighter, rescue rope expert in his personal and volunteer life as a firefighter and I guess a rope rigger.
Yeah. So let me get this straight. How does this? You are a firefighter and you do rescues, rope rescues, but you also you kind of said that that's your volunteer stuff, and that professionally you are a professional climber and you do rope rescue work professionally as well. So tell us a little bit about that.
That is correct. So I've been on the road for the last 15, 17 years, living as a rope access technician. And in North America, that means that I am certified by an organization who has our best practice standards from SPRAT, which stands for Society of Professional Rope Access Technicians. You can find them at sprat.org. There's a better explanation than I can give you in this short time that we have.
Sure.
There. When I joined, there was less than 3,000 technicians in North America. Now, I believe from what was posted from our latest get-together assembly of SPRAT, our yearly was over 7,000. So still, we are very young. When I came in, it was merely 15 to 20 years old. Now I've been in it for a decade or a little bit more. So now we're at 30 years old. This has come across the pond from Europe and international trades, as well as California's Department of Reclamation back in the 80s.
Okay.
These two cavers, mountaineers, chimney cleaners, you know, all that stuff that happened over in Europe hundreds of years ago was then brought here and used in recreational methods as far as mountaineering, mountain climbing, caving, and then in California, the Department of Reclamation, who had to deal with water in their adverse environments, needed a way to access or create, maintain, or, you know, figure out how to manage these things.
Mm-hmm.
So the Department of Reclamation in California was a guiding spearhead to create this type of industry. And then you had manufacturers from the fire and rescue community that brought their expertise to it, which then created SPRAT, Society of Professional Rope Access Technicians.
So I'm going to ask you, is this something that is
exactly
in your wheelhouse? Yes. Okay. So that's now for those of you that don't know what we're looking at, I just brought up a picture of the rescue of a truck driver. It was a Cisco truck in Kentucky that was going across a bridge. It TC'd. It's like something out of a Superman movie. The truck is hanging onto the bridge by the center of the trailer. The cab of the truck is still attached to the trailer, but is completely hanging off and has a destroyed cab. But the driver was okay and he was still in it. He was just hanging off the edge of a bridge. And so this picture that I put up is a rescue climber on a rope system that roped down to the cab of the truck, got the driver out, and is pulling him to safety. So tell us about what we're looking at here real briefly and how this ties into like what you do.
So from this picture, I would assume, based on what I can see from a still image, is that this rescuer has been lowered down by a team of rope technicians with a main line and a backup line. So if the main line fails, they have a secondary for as far as fall protection and industry. So he is lowered down to
belay.
He has a main line and he has a belay.
Okay.
Main line fails, belay picks up, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So technically he's being held by the main line and belayed by the secondary line. They're lowered down to the area that he needs to be. He will secure the victim, tie him to himself or secure him to the line, which the best way to say this in our best practice is that we secure them to the line, which is a secondary connection to us. We don't directly connect him to us. So if there's an issue, we can separate from him. He can separate from us, him or her, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all right with
and
it.
And just trying to be PC, man.
Yeah.
The victim can be rescued should there be an issue with the rescuer. The rescuer can be saved if there's an issue with the victim. So we have separate connections to the same system, which then we are hauled up by a team of rescue technicians above and is saved.
So is that to avoid losing the technician and the victim? Like it's not a, once they're connected, it's a, we can save one and not the other if necessary, or it's not, we're not going to lose them both.
Exactly. Right. Okay. We don't want to risk a life to save a life, but we will. Sure.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
That's the last thing we want to do is put another life in danger to save a life. If we can, if we can mitigate that in some way, shape or form, we will.
Right. Right. Okay. So I assume then, having kind of gotten into this industry, you work with a lot of different agencies doing search and rescue, operations, not just, I mean, obviously you're a volunteer firefighter. And so there's that element that you bring a lot of skill set to your local fire departments that they wouldn't have otherwise. But it sounds like you even in your daily professional life for your paying job, still do a lot of this stuff for public safety and for, rescue and stuff as well.
My day job is just as dangerous as any paid volunteer, civil servant.
Right.
When you respond to a call, we don't respond to a call. Our call is to go to work every day.
Right.
Our call is to, you know, climb that 300-foot tower, rappel down from it, do our maintenance, do our work, do our inspections, provide information,
right,
and then come on down safely. So we're answering a call every day at 8 a.m. or whatever our shift is, 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., 12-hour shift, whatever the case may be.
Right, whatever the particular job is. But you work with different agencies because
the scope is, right.
That's right. Okay. Got it. So you're more like Your unit is more like it's a specialized unit that gets called out for stuff, and contracted for stuff. Or so if you've got a fire department that has a rope rescue and they don't have anybody, they're going to call and you guys are local to them, they're going to call you out.
Yes.
Okay. And then on top of that, you do the volunteer fire stuff. So your fire department benefits from it as well.
True.
Is there anybody from you on your fire departments that has the same experience or similar experience or skill sets as you do? Or are you pretty much it?
It doesn't sound like this is a one-man job. 9 months, so I'm a member of a new fire department. So I don't. Okay. There is a county team that is specialized to what I'm aware of is equivalent to the industrial skills.
Well, so, then
Go ahead,
Chuck. I guess our last the same question, but your previous agency that you worked for, and I want to say when we talked, I think you said something like 10 years or something like that. You worked there.
Yeah.
Am I wrong? Okay.
No.
What was the did the people there match your skill set, or did you have to teach them, or how did that look?
Yeah, that's a good question. We had there was probably 30 people on our roster, right?
Okay.
On our roster that would attend calls, attend training, and so forth. We may have 60 or 70 or 80 people on our roster, but we have 30 that are active. Now, in that 30, there is, to my understanding, 7 different disciplines in the technical rescue field, according to NFPA 1006, which is dive, which is automotive, which is trench, which is confined space, which is, you know, rope. So, I mean, mm-hmm. and that's just an example. There's many sure. more. Agricultural issue, you know, equipment, heavy mm-hmm. rescue, which we're talking about heavy automotive. So each one of us has a skill in a certain way, but we all have base skills that we can support those who have the upper level skills in that specific.
Right, you have a specialist.
Yes.
But you all start with the base level skills, right. And then you
the specialist will take command. We will support him or her for that
matter. And now, how did you get into firefighting?
Through technical rescue.
Okay.
I was a technical rescuer in North Carolina until I took a freelance job. Somebody called a friend in my network called me and said, "Hey, you want to come and work in New York City and hang off the skyscrapers in Manhattan for 6 months this summer?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure. You're going to pay me for that? I'm a down." So that's what I did. I went and got 6 months in. Those 6 months were up. The company said, "Hey, we want you to stay. We need people with your skill set to continue our business. So what do you need to move up here?" I relocated from Raleigh as a home base to New Jersey. And then I got off the road. I stopped traveling and I dedicated 3 years to hanging off of skyscrapers in Manhattan.
Ugh. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not afraid of heights, but that sounds terrible.
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun. That, you know, that's like, you
nobody
see the guy
can have the same view in the world. Nobody will ever have the pictures that I have or my friend.
I agree. 100% agree. And I would love for you to send us some of those pictures so I can see what your view looks like and I can post them and share them with our listeners.
Yeah.
I don't know. Here's the thing. I just don't know that I ever have. I'd rather be Superman than Spider-Man.
I understand. And there's a picture on this side. It's Spider-Man. You know, that's something I grew up with. That's old comic stuff. You know what I mean? And that's what I grew up with. And I didn't know what I wanted to do coming out of high school. My dad was a programmer from the late 70s to early 80s. You know what I mean?
Right.
He went into the Marines, and that's what he fell into. My formal degree is database management.
You're far from that. Yeah.
Yeah. I went to play with that, and it was like, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Right.
But I
that's kind of like where I'm heading.
Climbing.
Yeah.
In an early age, and I followed that, and it piqued my interest. And that's, you know, I was an arborist for 15 years before I got into rescue and into industrial and into fire. So
now, when you were in New York, you were just doing the maintenance off those buildings, but did you ever work with like a volunteer firefighting outfit there where you had to do like aerial rescues off of skyscrapers or anything like that to assist
Waldwick, New Jersey, North New Jersey, is where I became a firefighter, where I got my firefighter one.
Got it.
I was introduced to them because I was used to being at my rescue squad in North Carolina. And when I was home, there were opportunities to interact, to train, to teach, to pass on knowledge, to gain knowledge. And when I got to Waldwick, I was only working in the city every day. And, you know, I just went up to the local fire department. It was like, "Do you guys have any tech rescue up here?" And they're like, "No, we have a county team, but you have to be a member of the local department." So she said, "What's your skill set?" And I explained to him, and he was like, "Well, teach us ropes and we'll teach you fire." So I went through fire school, I got my firefighter one, and that's where I began my firefighter career. I don't claim to be a firefighter. I haven't seen a lot of work as a firefighter. I'll be the first one to admit that. I'll be the last one to say that I'm a firefighter. Yes, I've been trained. I know fire science. I have an understanding, and I want to serve. But
so
I'm no big...
with your specialized skills, sending you out to just any old fire is kind of a waste of resources. You're a specialist.
Yeah.
As a volunteer.
Yeah.
You go when you're called.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I mean, that's true. We know that. I'm just saying in terms of like, if I was managing my resources as a chief or as a, you know, commander or whatever, I would look at, you know, bottom line is some people have specialized skills and you use them for certain things. You keep them available for certain things. And you are in some degrees one of those people, it sounds like.
I would agree, but at the same time, I'm there to serve.
Right. And that's the way we all are, right?
It's like, not about, you know what I mean? When we have 99.9% calls of auto accidents, fire, CO2, you know, just, you know, aid and assist. We have 0.1% of high angle calls.
Right.
I'm going to be a team member. I'm going to show up. I'm going to be a grunt. I'm going to do what I'm told. I'm going to do what I know, and I'll follow procedure.
Yeah.
But
you're going to work the AMBU bag on the CPR on the 80-year-old woman because they told you.
The hydrant. I'm going to pull the hose. Exactly. I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be that guy.
Until that time where they're like, hey, we have a rescue that needs to be rappelled down. It's pretty precarious. It's pretty hairy. Right.
You know,
automotive. And then you were like,
yeah,
put me in, coach.
This is my wheelhouse. They're going to be like, get Derek up here. Let's start working this.
So my next question is that you sent a link in regarding a pretty precarious situation.
Yeah.
What's all that about? If you could get into that, we would love to hear that. I mean, it looked interesting from the clip that you sent.
I like that you're doing a good job pretending to be surprised that we were going to ask you about that.
Yeah, because I did ask prior to like a list of questions and whatnot, but I did want to give you somewhat of a resume of, you know, you guys are looking for stories, which is cool. I could tell you a bunch of firefighting stories. I could tell you a bunch of ugly stuff, but who wants to commemorate that? Let's commemorate the times that all those times, in addition to the times that we were a big success that made news, right? This is what our culture is about right now.
I don't think many people want to commemorate that. I think that they want to share it for the simple fact that it may have affected them in a certain way and how they got over it. And I think that's what we really love to strive towards, is when someone has something they dealt with that's fucking nasty, right? You saw a child die, or you dealt with this person who ended up dying in a horrific manner, and you tell that story, and then you're like, and this is everything that I dealt with since, and this is the nightmares I had, and this is what I did to help myself cope. And that, I think, is the strongest power. And not to mention, we used to say it so many times before, we are a self-help podcast and a group therapy podcast without being that, right? We like to help.
Yeah, let me correct myself. Commemorate was the wrong word. That was exactly
it's okay.
The wrong word.
No, I get what you mean. I think you're saying it's important 100%. To celebrate the wins too.
Yes.
True.
And we love those too.
Because there's too much negativity that feeds the world right now.
Yeah.
And just in my, and I won't get into that. That's
a whole other episode.
But Chuck, you're so right. And please forgive me. And those that are listening, it was not about a commemoration. Either. It's about honoring those who have served and those we have lost that were served and those who were lost in accidents and ugliness of this world.
Yeah.
Right? 100%. So with that, I'll move on. On Sunday, September 8th, I was called by a member of our niche network. Remember, there was only 3,000 to 5,000 of us, industrial rope access technicians in North America.
Right. And if you think law enforcement is a small community, there's 700,000 cops nationwide. Imagine if law enforcement is a small community at 700,000. Imagine how small this community less than is 10. At only 5,000.
Right. Yeah. So I got a call from a member of my network on the East Coast that said, we have a possible emergency. Are you available? Now, I don't know where I was on that list. I could have been 20th. I don't care.
Right.
I still got the call. I was available. Right. I answered. And 5 hours, or let me say, 3 hours later, I got confirmation. And 5 hours later, I was in Brunswick, Georgia, okay, where a ship called the Golden Ray, which was a 650-foot long ship, 71,000-ton car carrier transport, had struck ground, listed, struck ground, as and it was laying 90 degrees on its side, and 20 people had been rescued out of it in the midst of a fire in its cargo hold. Now, a fire in a car carrying vessel with soft straps. So now we're talking about heat that's going to stop, that's holding the car still. You add heat to that, they're going to fail. Cars stack on top of each other, on top of each other, on top of each other. And now you have fuel, you have oil, you have acid, you have all kinds of other, you know, fluids. And if I see the picture that you've posted, look at the blackness and the smoke that is coming out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have a major hazmat that scenario
that is burning through the side of the hull of a ship. It was that hot in there.
Right.
So
now, for those of you that are watching on YouTube, we have a picture of the ship and have it being sideways, and it's legit. Like that shit is on its side. Like it is not 90 degrees. It's more like 105 degrees, but it's pretty close. Like, anyway.
So we arrived about, close to midnight Eastern time. And the salvage master, which is the main head of everything, even the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard was there. The head Coast Guard guy was working in coordination with the salvage master in order to coordinate.
Mm-hmm.
When we arrived, we were told there were four people missing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was called big of for a salvage ship. Job. I was called to possibly go in and get the black box, come back out. No people. It wasn't a personal livelihood, people involved type of thing. It was like, hey, right, are you available for a salvage? Yeah, I got
when four. You get there, it changed.
Everything changed.
Ooh,
everything changed.
That's a gut punch.
And we were told that 8 a.m., we would arrive at a Coast Guard station. We would be flown out to the ship. We'd be dropped off. It was our job to, they informed us that there was communication inside the hull, but and was heard by tugboats who were maintaining the, you know, the corridor around the ship. And so there's communication. There's people alive inside. We needed to locate, breach, and get them out.
Wow.
So
that's pretty
welcome
intense.
To Brunswick, Georgia for a salvage mission that you're just going to go get a black box or something. Just go get information.
And now, next thing you know, you're now in a recovery, not just of the black box, but of three living souls. And not to mention, now you're dealing with a hazmat scenario because of all the car stuff that's on fire, the rubber, the acid, the oil, the fuel.
Exactly.
All that shit is now ignited.
Right. Methyl ethyl bad shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That changes everything. Chuck, that's a really good point, because that was our biggest things is before we could do anything to breach, we had to locate.
Right.
Now, us guys are thinking in our head, okay, if we're going down a ship and it's sideways, we may have to preliminary. We're trying to pre-plan. Right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. What environment are we going into, and what could we expect? Where could they be? And how can we pre-plan if they're on a horizontal span, or if they're on a vertical span? Do we need to make a work platform? Do we need to have that at the ready? So when we get there, we've got a few ideas about how we may be able to start a breaching program, or how to access these people inside the ship. Depending on where their location is. Luckily, they were on a horizontal plane that we were standing on. They were in the gear room outside of the mechanical, engine room, which is basically that bottom little V shape of every ship, the bottom of every ship where all those big pipes that turn that turbine, all those bearings, all that oil, all that hydraulics of moving the rudders. We were in that bottom mechanical area that had all that toxicity after a fire that had already burned through the hull of a ship. Just like Chuck said. So
Derek,
we locate where the tapping's coming from, and we have a mag drill, which is electromagnetic. Go, Chuck.
One second. I don't think you're able to hear me. There's a bad echo. I don't know if it's us.
I'm getting it from you too.
Okay.
You guys are getting a bad echo? I'm not getting any bad echo. Yeah.
It's rough. I don't know if it's going to be coming through on the recording. It was 31, like 40 when I hit pause for a second.
You hit that? What did you pause?
No, I didn't pause shit. It's still recording. So I just want to leave the time now, Chuck. Is it better?
It sounds cleaner on my end because I heard an echo with me, and then I heard an echo with you.
Okay, it might have just been the internet. Are you? Yeah, it might have just been the internet. Anyway, okay, go ahead.
Just jot down 3140. I think that's around the time that I said something. Okay, continue. Sorry, Derek.
No problem. So we found the knocking to be located in the mechanical areas behind the engine room or in the engine room of the boat, which is the lowest V-hole part of a ship, where all these drive shafts are going to, you know, turn the propellers, how to move the rudders. So we've got a lot of mechanicals in there. But luckily, because it was listed, it was more of a horizontal than a vertical for us. So our initial cut was a slow cut oiled 3-inch puck with a magnetically stimulated drill. So it's a mag drill. What I know is a mag drill. It's an electromagnetic drill. You set down, you plug it in, turn on the power, you got an electromagnet that holds it to the hole, and then you basically, you know, drill into the surface nice and slow. No hot work was ever allowed due to the possible the environment inside of this ship. We've already had a fire. We already know there's oil. We already know there's gas. We already know there's hydraulic fluid. You know what I mean? So we've got to be aware. We drilled an initial hole, put a sniffer in there to test the environment, and then started, you know, and then tried to communicate with those who were tapping on the hole, which we should have been in that region, and we were.
So what happened?
The first thing was we established communication, we sent water, and we established another hole so that we could start pushing air, fresh air in. And then we maintained the air quality in there as we basically we had a steel backpack air blower suspended from the side of the ship to be able to blow into the force air into the ship, good air. As we started to create a bigger hole or hatch for them to be able to escape. And basically we took the same mag drill with the same three inch punch and stitched a bunch of holes together on every side.
How long did that take?
About 3 hours.
So not only are you dealing with a fucking boat on its side with all this chemicals that are just being burned now. So now you have a nasty hazmat situation and you are taking a 3-inch fucking drill and stitching together little holes. Basically, if you were to take like a paper cut, a paper hole punch, and you're just doing this all the way around to make a hole big enough so that they can get out. Man, were you guys worried about like them getting too hot in there or the air quality getting too toxic? What was going through your mind at that point?
We were focused on the mission. We were focused on the mission that there were four, you know, it could have only been one person that was communicating, tapping on a hole. It didn't matter to us. We knew that there was four people and we had communication with one and we needed to get that one out. So we just focused on getting our materials here. I was staged at the top as another member and equipment on top of the ship. We rappelled down the side of the bottom of the ship to get to that V hole where the mechanics are. And there were other operators working there as I manned the top. Now, it was ambient temperature inside the ship was 140. Ambient temperature outside of the ship was 120, 130.
Holy shit, the oven.
By the time I got off the top of the, which I'll call the top, but we'll call the side of the ship, and rappelled down to get to the operation and bring extra equipment and personnel, I was experiencing heat issues. I was
heat exhaustion kind of thing.
Heat exhaustion, heat stroke.
Okay.
There was a tugboat there supported by the Coast Guard with them on it. They had gotten a shelter to protect them from, you know, just a pop-up tent was to protect from heat while we did these drills. Now I had to step off into the tugboat to cool off a little bit, get myself back together and then rejoin the team and the procedure. And after we had gotten two sides of this punched out with that one mag drill, we gained a second mag drill and we started punching out the third and fourth side and stitching it together. So,
you know, pardon me for I don't know if this is a comparison that you've ever had made, but this sounds to me not in the strictest sense, but in the preparation and it's like going into a lab. There's so much bad stuff. There's so much unknowns. You're in there. You can only be in there for a certain amount of time. You got to come out and take rest periods. There's chemicals around lurking around every corner. There's hidden dangers. It takes very specialized equipment, you know, and I know the actual nuts and bolts of what you're doing are different, but the safety concepts and the strain on the body and some of the dangerous hidden chemical hazards, those are all very similar and very real, because I think Derek has been doing this so long, he's kind of burying the lead, which is at any second this thing's gonna go bad, right? Like everybody's pretty calm.
You have to be aware of that, but you can't focus on that.
Exactly. You can't do your job under the specter of, oh, I'm scared. I tuck my tail between my legs and I do everything tentative. Right. You go boldly, right? I hate that sounded like Star Trek. You go aggressively. you address the threat, you know, you don't shy away from it. But at the same time, that mindset, that threat level, that the kind of, you know, catching a tiger by the tail is ever present.
And I know, I'm confident. I was a member of a 5-man team. So there were four other guys, the owner of the salvage company, and then One other guy on that team was rescue or, you know, civil service or fire certified. The other two were just top level or level three SPRET technicians. So they're aware. They just didn't have the additional certification or training of fire awareness, but everything else was there. So, right, and it didn't really matter. This was just to me, you could simplify this as a rope access job. Rappel down, cut out with this type of thing, do it, bang, bang, done. All right. That was an easy industrial job. If you were to look at this from an industrial rope access viewpoint, this was show up, get to your point, breach the hole, and you're done, which is not uncommon in our industrial world.
Mm-hmm.
We're all certified and ready to create this experience or this service to our customers. But because it was a rescue mission, I'm trying to keep it simple.
Yeah, no, I get it. It's funny.
To provide this service in a rescue situation where lives are at stake, it heightens our awareness.
Mm-hmm.
As much as maybe outside of the actual mission, there may have been X, Y, and Z, but the mission was accomplished the best way I don't know any of us on that team that could go back and say, I wish I would have done this better. You know what I mean?
Right, because you were operating at your top,
skill level. We were trained technicians to do X, Y, and Z. We were given our scope. We went, we had a plan, we did not deviate, it worked, and it was done.
Sure.
So it took you 3 hours to stitch that hole together. What happened once you popped that hole out?
I have a video of that, and I'll share it with you guys.
Yeah, we'd love to put it on. If we can share it as well, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I've got pictures and whatnot that I'll share with you guys. You can stitch into this. But there's a video of the last hole being connected to and stitching that, and how we had to rig that very sharp piece of metal that we were abstracting to open the hole. Mm-hmm. Because now you have teeth on either side, right? If you stitch holes together, all you have is this jagged edge on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
How do you secure that with a rope or webbing? Or, you know, it came down to unique rigging and understanding the forces and X, Y, and Z. You know, we mitigated the hazard.
Right.
And it worked flawlessly.
What'd you use?
A series of webbing and straps.
Oh,
knowing just that this piece of metal, this square piece of metal could not be, knowing the thickness of this hole and knowing understanding the piece of this metal, we knew that it could not be over 100 pounds.
Sure. And
if we lifted it, if we added our stress and our weight to it gradually instead of dynamically on a sharp force, we could mitigate those edges to a degree.
Sure.
Enough to get it up and out of the way so it wouldn't drop on the guys that were below us.
Okay.
And so as that came up and out, you could see a small reflection in my video of where the guys were. And we're all cheering and happy and everything. And then we got as much what I know is pig mat from the wind industry or just oil absorbent matting, right?
Mm-hmm.
We wrapped the sides of the hole that was still there, the sharp edges, with as much as we could, stuck a ladder down, and we were able to get those guys out.
What was the condition of them when you were getting them out?
Complete darkness.
It's 140 degrees while you're in there operating, and they're just stuck in a freaking oven.
They were down to skivvies. They shed every piece of clothing that they could. They were covered in oil. They were dehydrated. They were a little bit disoriented, which is understandable. They had been in complete darkness, fire and this whole environment, possibly toxic environment, for 30 hours.
Yeah.
Before we even landed on the ship.
Well, hold on. Pump the brakes. You said 30 hours?
So my understanding is that the ship went over Sunday afternoon, Sunday morning, or Sunday night. I don't have specifics on that. Sunday, September 8th, this ship was headed out of the Brunswick, Georgia port with cars, 4,800 cars on it.
Uh-huh.
It incurred an issue and caught on fire and listed before it reached international waters, potentially blocking the lanes of any other ships coming or going out of the port. This is the biggest port, automotive port, between. This is the biggest southern automotive port in America. Baltimore is the next one.
Okay.
So all the automotive cars that are being shipped from, you know, the east, come through the Panama Canal, come up here. This is the first place they hit, Brunswick, Georgia. And then from there, they go to Baltimore.
So 30 hours.
Yep.
You guys get the hull open. How many people do you know at this point that how many people are still trapped inside?
There were four people that were missing at the time.
Okay. So you did know that.
Yes.
Okay. And was there any communication with them whatsoever? So
we're tapping on the hole, and until we actually made our first breach, no.
Wow. Okay. So you were, did you do the whole, like I saw the Poseidon Adventure. Do you tap on the hull and they tapped back? You guys were able to confirm people were alive in there. But other than that,
Coast Guard was able to do that for us.
Okay. Oh, got it. Okay. So then you open the hatch, or you guys cut the hole open. You make a hatch. I guess it's not really a hatch except for the fact that you made it a hatch. It was the hull.
A rather sharp edged hatch.
Right. Right. And so now after you get the hull breached, what's the next step for you guys? Is do you direct people to the breach? How do you, I'm curious, like, cause that's a big ship.
Yeah. So we have, in the time that we're breaching the hull, we have somebody communicating. These are South Korean men who are in the ship. So everybody, there was 20 people who were evacuated during the fire Sunday night. Or it should have been Saturday night, Sunday morning. We got the call Sunday afternoon. We showed up Sunday night. Excuse me. Are informed that there are four people missing, and they have communication by somebody tapping on a hole Saturday night at about roundabout midnight Eastern time when we all arrive.
Mm-hmm.
8 a.m. We go out, we breach. As soon as we open that hole, as soon as we open a hole, we start communicating. You know, we have somebody there from the Coast Guard. One of the gentlemen inside could speak very little English.
Right.
So we said, how many are you? What do you need? How can we help? We're coming to get you. So water, you know, water bottles can fit through a 3-inch hole. We strung a bunch of water bottles on a rope and dropped one, you know, a long, you know, 20, 30 right. footy rope with water bottles strung on it to give them to hydrate. We pushed air. We monitored air as we were pushing air and created more options to be able to change the environment that they had been stuck in to make it more, to make it easier for them to survive until we could open up that hole. Once that hole was open, we inserted a ladder in order for those to be able to, and added light. Mm-hmm. Somebody went down and assessed those who would get on the ladder. We had three of the four guys right there.
Okay.
Three of the four guys were right there. So within 4 hours of landing on the ship, we had three guys out.
That's amazing.
Problem is, our fourth guy is in the engine room, which is secured by I want to say 15 millimeter ballistic glass.
Oh, so that's not good.
Or Krylon or some type of ballistic, you know.
Yeah. Material.
Due to piracy.
Okay.
So they had protected the engine room should somebody come in and try and hijack the ship.
Mm-hmm.
When the ship went down, that locked. So one man was trapped in there.
Great.
While we were trying to open this hole, they requested an axe, anything they could do to go get their friend out. These guys were okay, but yet knew that their friend was still in trouble. And they requested resources to be able to help him. We tried to do what we, you know, we're limited. Our job is to get these guys out first, then we'll deal with the next guy.
Those are solid homies right there.
Right, right. Yeah. These.
So they weren't able to free him.
There's more to that because I got to meet them afterwards, and it's phenomenal. their man was probably 40 feet back from our hole. 40 to 60 feet back from our hole. It was so hot in there that another team from another salvage company came in and was going through the confined space protocol. And once they got in there, it was just not doable. It was too hot. You know, it was difficult.
Do you have an estimate on temperature readings inside the ship?
Like I said, 130 to 140.
Wow.
I know. So what happens to that 140 internally? It took two or three crews to swap out within a matter. It took another 3 hours to get that fourth gentleman out. And they were using grinders, using, you know, battery powered tools to try and grind through this ballistic material that was protecting the engine room. Finally, they were able to get him out. It took another 4 hours to get that gentleman out. But all four of the crew that was missing from Saturday night from the original rescue, they all walked out of that hole.
Wow. That's crazy. Wow. I'm surprised you guys were able to get that fourth gentleman out. I mean, that's wild.
Like I said, our crew of five guys, it took everything we had just to get that hole and get those guys out. So luckily there was another two or three salvage crews that were on standby, and they were asking, let us get in, let us get in, let us get in. And we're like, we got to complete our mission, you know, and we weren't being ignorant and we weren't being bullheaded. Was that, look, as soon as we open this hole, you guys are good to go. Just get ready. You know, let us establish this one access area. And, I just got to give it to the fortitude of the guys inside number one. And our crew and the other crews that went in, our crew that established the ability to go in, and the crews that went in. It wasn't always pretty. I'll be the first one to tell you that. And I won't go into detail, but we did what we had to do. We didn't lose anybody. We kept everybody safe. And we brought everybody home.
And that's what's important.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the important part.
Yeah.
So
how were they when you got them out? Like, what were those conversations like? How much gratification did they have to be saved?
They were very, obviously, you're going to be very happy. They're very appreciative. They were very appreciative. There was one gentleman who struggled because it was a little bit too much mentally, and we brought him out, and he was okay, you know, physically, and that was fine. You can't, you know, when a couple of them came out and they're like, okay, now, you know, and he struggled to get out, and, you know, we get to that point where he's like, I can't. So we got to send somebody in to be able to help him, you know, assist him get out. And I don't blame the guy. I don't blame the guy being in the dark for over 24 hours, the heat, the, you know, just to be overwhelmed. I've been overwhelmed with less than that.
Right.
Damn right.
To be honest with you. So, you know, we brought a guy out in a, you know, a stretcher, put him on a boat, took him out, got him checked, and he's fine. What do you say?
What I think is crazy is that you came out there for a salvage mission for a fucking black box, and they all good, willing, and knowing that there were four people stuck in there, and yet it took them from what 10 p.m. midnight the day prior to 8 a.m. the morning next morning to send out a crew to get these people.
It took them over extricated. 24 hours. Saturday night, the ship went down. Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, we got a call. Sunday night, we showed up.
I think you're talking about, though, having dealt with emergency management, I think some of that lag time, some of that lag time is going to be figuring out what they had, who to call. You know what I mean? So,
and the Coast Guard did a great job at that. They did what they were supposed to do.
Right.
They had limited knowledge until they got that knock, knock, knock. They maintained somebody there at that ship. There were three tugboats at least that maintained that ship did not drift off. Right. And in the meantime, survivors were inside tapping on the, which was relayed back to the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard, you know what I mean? The Coast Guard did everything right. I can't say that anything, honestly, I would say if anything else, what I'm proud of is the hierarchy of management, the NIMS,
right? You know,
the NIMS system. I can't say that it was. I don't know it that well to say that they operated exactly the way it was, but that was the best managed incident I have ever experienced in my decade of being a civil rescue servant.
Yeah,
wow. That's all I got to say.
Put this in perspective for people listening. This isn't like 911 where you're listening or you're watching a TV show and it's an hour long and they get all this shit done and they get on scene. Next thing you know, they're getting the people out like fast. This is not how that works. I mean, this takes a lot of time to get resources. Yeah, it's crazy. And this just, it's crazy to think that it took that long, but also, like, it's great that you were able to extricate everybody, get them all out safely. But I got to tell you, thinking like being on the inside, man, I'd be like, this is it. This is how we go, guys. Like this, you're sitting there knocking, hoping someone hears you, hoping you don't burn to death.
That monkey in the cage. And those guys on the boat would respond every hour. Wow. Let them know.
That's crazy.
You know,
And you didn't lose anybody, and we didn't lose any, like, you didn't use any of your team. You didn't lose any of those people. We would definitely appreciate you sending us those pictures. That would be amazing.
I'd be happy to.
Yeah. Well, shoot. Now I want to have you come back on and tell firefighter stories, because we didn't even get to your firefighter stuff, but that rescue is pretty cool. Cause you always see it, but you never hear like from the people that do it. So, you know, that's pretty bitching. It's gotta be. It seems like you kind of fell into it through a natural progression of things.
Exactly. And I fell into it because of a network that I had. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I may have been the 20th person they call on that list because nobody else was available. I don't care what number I was on. I got called. I was able to attend.
And you answer that call for service.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, we always like to let our guests dedicate their episode to somebody. And I guess you do have a dedication. Chuck, did you pull it up? Are you presenting it?
He has a dedication as well, and I have a dedication as well. I know we spoke earlier, and I'm going to let you go, Derek, with your dedication, and I'm going to follow up with a listener dedication.
Got it.
Just like we've talked about in this, and that last statement that we have, I want to dedicate this to all those who have the heart to serve and who have answered the call.
Right.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Amen to that. Now, we've been getting a lot of listener dedication sent to the email, and this is one of them. And this was sent in by Matthew. I'm not going to say your last name for operational security purposes because you didn't let me know if I could, but I'm just going to say your first name. Matthew sent this in.
And it first started out in his hometown, North Carolina, as a code blue alert. From what he has read, this is sadly the 123rd officer to die in 2023. Too many, Sergeant Philip Dale Nix. This goes out to you, brother, and to your family. Your badge number was 873. Sergeant Nix was the supervisor of the Greensboro Police Family Victims Unit. His colleagues called him the true victims advocate and a pillar in the community. Nix was 23 years a veteran with the Greensboro Police Department, a husband, and a father. Nix was shot on December 30th when he reportedly confronted people attempting to steal beer from a Sheetz gas station on Sandy Ridge Road off Interstate 40. Three suspects were later caught in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and charged in his death. The suspect who shot Nix is looking at life in prison or the death penalty if convicted. Sergeant Nix embodied the very best of law enforcement. He was a consummate professional, a good and decent person, and he was supervised. And was beloved to the community of Greensboro. It should come as no surprise that Sergeant Nix, like so many other officers, comes from a family with a long legacy of public service. This was said by Tills. For as impressive as Sergeant Nix was for his exemplary work in uniform, it was his job as a family man, a loving husband, a father, and a son that made him the man he was.
Well, rest easy, brother. We got it from here. And Chuck, do you have anything else to take us out as we finish up this week?
I do. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you like today's podcast and the content we provide, please help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever podcast platform you listen to us on. We're also available on YouTube, as well as every other major podcasting platform. If you want to help us out, please follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Our Instagram is @war_stories_official and our Facebook @warstoriespodcast. If you already follow us, please like and share our posts. You can also click the link in that bio on Instagram or Facebook to get to our website, our socials, our YouTube, the podcast stuff, everything. Our website is www.warstoriesofficial.com. We have some gear available there if you feel so inclined to buy it. If you feel like you want to be featured on the show, you have a story you think you want to share or think you could be featured, go to booking.warstories@gmail.com and I can get you booked. Again, that is booking.warstories@gmail.com. We are always looking for veterans, law enforcement, firefighters, medics, but also corrections officers, dispatchers, and nurses. I want to say thank you for the support. Stay safe.
Yep. And I want to tack on to that. If you're emailing for, we have not merged the two social media emails and stuff like that yet. So I'm trying to explain this as best as I can. If you're sending us a joke, send it to Locker Room. If you're sending us something to make Chuck throw up, send it to Locker Room. If you're sending something that you want us to do on our Locker Room Live segment, send it to the Locker Room email address. If you want to talk to me or send me a dedication or a question or something, mailbag@warstories@gmail.com, mailbag.warstories@gmail.com, excuse me. If you want to book yourself on the show, email chuck@booking.warstories@gmail.com. But I still get emails to mailbag that are people expressing interest to be on the show, and then I forward them to Chuck and do nothing else with them. So cut me out. I'm the middleman. I'm okay with you eliminating my job, downsize the company, just go straight to Chuck, because I literally can't schedule my own life, let alone this podcast by myself. So that's why I have Chuck do it. So just wanted to remind you guys of that. And until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.